Jim Croce sang a song in the 70s. It was about time in a bottle. It starts with, if I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away just to spend them with you. Some of you might have that music playing in your head. I chose to not sing it because after such beautiful, special music, why would I do that? But I'd also like to then change things up just a little bit. So, Jim, here you go. This is time in a bottle. It's an hourglass. Many of you know what this is. There's games that can be played with this. This is supposed to be exactly an hour. I actually haven't tested it, but now we will. Time is in a bottle. As time is slipping away, time is going to be a part of the message today. So I'll just set this right here. Time's an interesting concept. Three quotes to give you to start with. Time is a precious commodity. I refuse to allow what little time I have to be contaminated with self-pity, anxiety, or boredom. That's Max Lucado. I'll read it again. Time is a precious commodity. I refuse to allow what little time I have to be contaminated by self-pity, anxiety, or boredom. Second quote, time is of more value than money. You can get more money, but you can't get more time. Jim Rohn. The last quote, Tina Seelig. You can use time to make money, but you can't buy more time. So there's a concept that time's important. Time, how much time is left, is a question that many have asked through the years. 1947, that was asked. The people who are working on the Manhattan Project asked the question, how much time is left? We have now just created the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb is the first time the world could be completely eradicated. How much time's left? Those scientists came up with something called the doomsday clock. The doomsday clock in 1947 was set initially at 7 minutes until midnight. So in 1947, the scientists that created the atomic bomb thought out of 24 hours, 23 of those hours have already passed. 53 minutes have already passed. The entire world is now living down to the last 7 minutes. The atomic, or sorry, the doomsday clock I learned is stored at the University of Chicago. I didn't realize that. Next time I'm in Chicago, I'll plan to go check on it. I'd encourage you to if you find this of interest. But today we're going to be talking about the biblical perspective on time, especially end time. We're going to be examining prophecy. Key events before Christ's return will be enhanced by thinking about the doomsday clock and our personal, watchful anticipation for Christ's return and the encouragement we should be able to draw from that. Many of us have heard in the past, the Bible is about one-third prophecy. I've heard that many times, and I just thought, with all the chapters about this person begat that person, begat that person, is it really about one-third? I did a quick search. According to J.B. Payne, the Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecy, he says it's 27%. So it's a quarter, it's a third, whatever it is, there's a lot of prophecy in the Bible. But I could say this, I rarely speak about prophecy when I'm asked to speak. Pretty rare. So let's start with this. I boldly predict, yea, I prophesy, that I will speak about prophecy today. Why am I qualified to do this? Well, at first I thought, I'm really not. And then I thought, well, I've heard many a sermon about prophecy. I've attended a few classes. I've read many articles and booklets. I try to stay current on world events from a variety of sources. So why not? But why not me? But also, why not you? What are your thoughts about prophecy? How often do you look and consider prophecy? And how much time is there before Christ comes back? Now, I'm not here to set a date, and we'll talk more about that momentarily. But just to consider that we are watchmen, at least a quarter of the Bible is about prophecy, we should consider things are going to get worse before they get better. But when Christ returns, that's going to be ushering in the wonderful world tomorrow. So I'd like to have the concept, instead of a doomsday clock, I was trying to come up with some different words. The great and glorious clock. I had these written down. The glad and rad clock. But I'll focus on the happy and snappy clock, or I'll just call it the happy day clock. Because when Christ returns, it's not going to be the end of the world as we know it, and all life is wiped away. And for the atheists that would believe that was it, that's not what happens. Sometime, at least 1 second before midnight, before the world would end as it would think it would end, Christ returns. And that's the happy day. It's the beginning of ushering in the world tomorrow. Now, when the scientists got together to create the doomsday clock, they asked the question. The same question is asked several times in the New Testament. So let's start with Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1. They weren't the only ones asking how much time. What can you tell us about the future? They were in some good company. So Acts chapter 1 and verse 6. Acts chapter 1 and verse 6. Together, when they had come together, they asked him, these are the disciples, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Christ, is this the time? How much time's left? Is this it? Is this the moment? What did Christ say? It's not for you to know times or seasons, which the Father's put in his own authority, but you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses to me in Jerusalem, in Judea, Samaria, and to the end of the earth. When he had spoken these things, they'd watched. He was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. So they asked him, is this the time? Christ said, nobody really knows the time, but here's what's coming. But now let's go to another portion where the question's asked a little bit differently. So Matthew chapter 24. And no surprise, we're going to spend most of our time here in Matthew chapter 24. Here, the way the disciples ask the question starts in verse 1. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 1. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, don't you see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. These are the Galilean fishermen, 70 miles away, come to Jerusalem. Christ is just explaining that that temple that's so huge, so beautiful, some of those stones weigh 100 tons. And Christ is saying, not one stone is going to be left one upon another. Verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately and said, here's the question. Tell us, when will these things be? What is the doomsday clock setting? When will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? That was the question. Matthew 24 is replicated in Mark 13 and Luke 21, but those are the exact same questions that are being asked. Now, I said that the doomsday clock was set at 7 minutes before midnight initially. It's gone back and forth through the time. Right now, it's set at 90 seconds. So the official setting on the doomsday clock, 1 minute and a half. So let's focus on Matthew 24, and let's look at it from a couple of perspectives. It probably isn't a surprise to say that prophecy is complicated. Probably not a surprise to say Matthew is complicated. Matthew 24. One of the parts that makes it complicated is consider when it was it written, about 50 AD. So Matthew's looking back about 20 years earlier, explaining what Christ said here. But then what is about to happen? Let's say about 20 years in the future, Jerusalem is overrun, the temple's destroyed. Now we'll be going between Matthew and Revelation. In Matthew, so you can think that there's a couple of different things. Some of the verses in Matthew can be focused on a singular event. It's Christ saying, in about 40 years, this temple is going to be destroyed. That's a singular event. Some things are dual events. There's parts of Matthew 24 that talk about this is going to happen and then Christ will return. That's completely separate and in the future. That's a different event than the fall of Jerusalem. And then some of this is written as encouragement for Christians over the last 2,000 years. How many times would Christians have gone through trials and struggles, and they're reading into this to be encouraged that as bad as things can be, it finishes with the happy day clock. Christ is going to return. So think about Matthew. There's the singular consideration of the fall of Jerusalem. There's the dual consideration of meaning what's happening before Christ returns. And then there's also the throughout, so plural. In Revelation was written in 90 AD. At that point, the temple had already fallen. So there's not the same looking back to the temple being fallen as a part of the Revelation portion. So hopefully that part makes sense. So let's continue on. So now, what are the signs? So how did Christ answer the question? Did he say, here's the date? No. In fact, it could have been much easier if he just would have gone this way. So Christ could have been asked the question. And what if he just would have started with verse 36? You're asking me a question. Well, here's the answer. In verse 36 of Matthew 24, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven. You ask me a question, you get an answer, there you go. Okay, next question. Oh, you didn't get that clearly enough? Oh, let's look at verse 42. Verse 42, watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord is coming. Oh, there's a second time I'm answering the question. Okay, anything else? That's not what Christ said, but we should remember, no man knows. But what did Christ say? He gave some signs. He gave some things to consider. So now let's continue with verse 4. Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Now, the word many is a big word, but we don't know exactly how big many is. Revelation 12, 9 said, the whole world's deceived. Well, we don't believe we are. There's a calling, there's the elect who's not deceived. How few is that not deceived group? I'm not counting. God knows. How many will be deceived? I don't know, but many is a lot. So let's continue on. So there is a part of deception. And I'm going to, as we go through some of these parts, I'm going to dig into the words, examples, and meanings. I'll just highlight here. The deception that's supposed to come from false Christs is mentioned three different times in a similar fashion in Matthew 24. This is false Christ. Coming up, there's going to be, don't be deceived by false prophets. Coming up after that says, watch out, don't be deceived by false Christ and false prophets. And that's when I'll go a little bit deeper into that. So I'll just pass over the false Christ mentioned here because we'll get into it in just a little bit. So many come in my name saying I'm the Christ will deceive many. What's next? There will be wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. It's pretty tough to not be troubled if there's wars and rumors of wars, especially if you're living in the war zone. Don't be troubled. All these things must come to pass. Now, once these things happen, does that mean Christ is going to return? Not yet. No, the end is not yet. Verse 7, nation will rise against nation, kingdom will rise against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. What I'd like to do is now transition to another chapter in Revelation. Now, you old timers might know exactly where we're going, but these signs that were just mentioned here are replicated in Revelation chapter 6. So let's go to Revelation chapter 6, and then you can hold your place back because we'll be going right back to Matthew 24. But Revelation chapter 6. So think about those signs that we just read about. Verse 1, now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, come and see. We're about to enter the world of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Many of you can remember the different pictures you would have seen, the horse colors and what they mean. There's a direct application of these that will then go back to Matthew 24 and line those up. I beheld first a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. I was reviewing a few different commentaries. Several of them are a little confused. Who's on the white horse? Some commentaries think it's Jesus Christ. We don't believe that that's the case. Why would that be? Go ahead and turn to Revelation chapter 19. So let's look at what happens when Christ is returning, and then let's do a quick compare contrast. So Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11. Now I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. Hey, it's another white horse. Is it the same white horse or is it different? There are some differences. Let's highlight that. 19 verse 11 of Revelation. And he who sat on him was called faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire. On his head were many crowns, a name written that no one knew except himself, clothed with a robe dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God. The armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses, more white horses. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he shall strike all nations. So what's the difference between these horses and the riders of the horses? Let's go back to Revelation chapter 6. White horse, he who sat on it, what does he have? In Revelation 19, it's a sword. Word of God is known as a double-edged sword. Here, it's a bow. Different. Secondly, there's the word crown. The word crown is two different Greek words. The Greek word for crown in Revelation 6 is a different Greek word than in Revelation chapter 19. The first one is called Stephanos. It's known as the victor's crown versus diadem or the royal crown on Revelation 19:11. Revelation 19 is also states that it's Christ, faithful and true. So horse number one, I don't think would be a controversial thing for us to agree with, is a false Christ. Horse number one, the white horse, is a false Christ. What about horse number two? Let's continue on. He opened the second seal in verse 3. I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." And another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, that people should kill one another. There was given to him a great sword. Horse number two, red, war, wars, rumors of wars, right? Horse number three, let's continue on. Third living creature, come and see. I looked and behold, a black horse. He who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and don't harm the oil and the wine." I do have to share, I was at the feast in Greece. Mr. Frank Fish mentioned there was a young child who was crying, and he said, "Do you know what that sound is? That's the sound of a growing church." I love that sound. So hopefully we can all appreciate that sound of a growing church. So let's continue on. What's the big deal about a quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley? So the expositor's commentary said that that was 12 times the price that that should have been worth, and that a daily wage earner would not be able to afford a single meal for themselves, let alone for their family, let alone for anything else. Now, we've gone through some hyperinflation here in America. That's caused some concern. What's the inflation rate? Well, you know, sometimes they play funny numbers with the games, and they're not including the inflation of gas and inflation of food. The biggest inflation that I've personally experienced was Egypt. I was there a couple of years ago, and the inflation rate in Egypt, I didn't realize this, but people were talking about just how much more expensive things are, and there's problems. So I did some research. Over the last 10 years, their average inflation is between 10 and 35%. They have had several years at 30 to 35% inflation. 35% inflation, if that happens year over year over year, most people just can't afford the basics in life. If you consider 20% inflation for 10 years, which Egypt's had more than that, that means that what used to equal a dollar is now $6.20. That means a $10 lunch or dinner now costs in Egypt $62. What's different here now? This is saying it would cost $120 for what would cost $10 today. So if you could only work and earn X amount, but all of a sudden there's a 12X increase in the cost of everything, That's why there's a famine. Now, famine could be caused by several things, which we'll get back into momentarily. But the idea of the black horse is dealing with the cost of food is exponentially high, likely tied to a famine. And then finally, the fourth horse. Now, I looked and behold, a pale horse. This pale, the color, it actually means a yellowish green. In my mind's eye, it's like a sickly, gross-looking, yellow-green colored horse. The name of him who sat on it was Death. Hades followed with him, and power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. So that was the tour of the four horses. Many of you know these horses, not personally, but it wasn't a surprise. But now, with that in mind, of those four categories of the four horses, let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. Let's reread, starting in verse 4. Take heed, no one deceives you. Many will come into my name, saying, I am the Christ, will deceive many. What color was the first horse? White. Second horse was red. You will hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you're not troubled. All these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. There is a continuation of wars and rumors of wars through the years, but that's not the final red horseman at the very end when it's going to get worse. Nation will rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Some research. What does that mean by nations and kingdoms? And nations means countries. Kingdoms can mean tribes. So as I would look at this, Ukraine, Russia, nation against nation fighting. Hamas, more of a tribe. So there could be wars of nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. What's next? There will be famines. Pale horse, or sorry, black horse is everything's 12x more expensive. Pestilence. This word pestilence can be translated plague. Those living through the bubonic plague, those living through the Spanish flu, even most recently, COVID, can be viewed as a plague or a pestilence that kills. Earthquakes, various places, these are the beginning of sorrows. But here's one last item I'd like to try to tie together. So we've got the four horses in Revelation. We've got them restated here in Matthew. Do you know what the factors are for the doomsday clock? So every January, those scientists gather back together and they see, is it time to move the clock up or back? The furthest back it went when things were looking pretty good in the early 90s was 17 minutes. Now, again, it's 90 seconds. They're going to be meeting this next month. What are their four factors? First factor, nuclear war. The more likely that a nuclear war will happen, the shorter the time will be in the readout. Well, that's the red horse, right? Second factor, bioterrorism. Well, that could also be the pale horse, pestilence. Third factor, climate change. Think of climate change as famines, things that could be naturally occurring, such as famines, earthquakes, could be similar. But there's a separation on the last one. They don't have anything for the white horse. Their fourth category is artificial intelligence. And they think that the more the AI takes off, that actually poses a risk for all mankind. So those are those four categories. Of course, there is no horse or AI. But I learned from a friend that we don't have to worry about it because Joshua already defeated it. So please turn with me to Joshua chapter 8. Joshua chapter 8. Some of you might already know where we're going. And David Permar is a friend. And after this joke, he's even a better friend. So, Joshua chapter 8 and verse 29. And the king of AI, he hanged on a tree until evening. As soon as the sun was down, Joshua commanded, they shall take his corpse down, cast it at the entrance of the gate of the city, raise it over a great heap of stones that remains to this day. So we don't have to worry about AI. Who's going to win? Joshua defeated AI way back then. Of course, I'm trying to just bring a smile. So let's go ahead and get back on point. So Matthew 24 again. Okay, so now let's start verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. You'll be hated by all namesakes, or all nations for my namesake. And then many will be offended. They'll betray one another, hate one another. Now here's the second time that the white horse is mentioned. Then many, so here's that word many again, many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. We're going to tie back into the false prophets, false Christ on the third one. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this, lawlessness will abound. So there are many things we can look at today that are just horrible. And it's something that even just a few decades ago would have been so completely different. So I'm going to see my mom tonight, 4 hours north of here. When I grew up going to high school and hunting season, school's in the middle of the cornfields. Some of my friends had pickup trucks in the parking lot. They would have rifles on the gun rack in the school parking lot. That was 30 years ago. School shootings weren't a thing. School shootings are horrific. To have now schools locked down for safety reasons, to have kids have to go through safety drills, and to have the fear of a school shooting, that wasn't a thing. That never crossed my mind. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we had to go through tornado drills, which was kind of dumb to sit in the hallway and put our hand over our heads, but that's different. So think about just the change. Because iniquity will grow, lawlessness will grow, the love of many will wax cold. Just this last week, an executive was murdered on the streets of New York. That was at 7 a.m. Now, I tell my kids, nothing good happens after midnight. 7 a.m., I was walking on that same street 1 month ago. Lawlessness will continue to abound, and the love of many will wax cold. One last thought on this. Think about the trauma that has been inflicted on our youth just simply due to COVID. Schools were shut down. Kids had to stay away. So some say that there's a lack of a social connection that's happened with youth. Loneliness is known as one of the great challenges for many. So the challenges of a lack of connectivity due to the school challenges with COVID, I think is going to just continue to amplify future problems. So there are very real, very serious challenges there. I did hear this last week that the media comes up with the word of the year. Do you know what the new word of the year is for this year? Brain rot. It says that that's what happens if a person's doom scrolling, meaning just keep going through whatever their favorite social media outlet is, that creates brain rot. Brain rot, iniquity, lawlessness, the challenges of today are just going to make this ultimately become even more difficult. Let's continue on. So verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. I will share a really short story. I ran track in high school. I was okay, not great. The 800 was my event. The Tri-County Invitational invited 16 teams together. And that day, my other senior buddy and I, we looked, and here comes the yearbook photographer. I thought, oh no, here are 16 teams with their fastest runners. We're going to be in the yearbook and we're going to be dead last. So here was our strategy. I said, on the first turn, photographer, set up there. And as soon as the race starts, get us on the very first curve, because there's four curves on the 800, get us at the very start. And Dave, let's just start out at a dead sprint. So that's what we did. So we started off with a sprint, and then 100 yards in, from there on, we were done. So we still finished near the last, which we expected, but we won for a little bit. But here's the reason I shared it. I just was thinking of this as I was driving down, was we knew there, we couldn't run that pace for 800. We had maybe 100 to hope that the picture would be taken. It never did get taken. I've never seen it, so it doesn't matter. But we're told here, we're not in a sprint. We're in this for the long run. There's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be good and bad, and there's going to be many trials. But we're not running this as a sprint to then stop. We're running this as a long-term marathon. Continue on to verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom, the gospel of the kingdom of God, will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So I did some thinking about this. When this verse was written, what would their initial impression have been? How is it possible for a gospel to be preached to the ends of all the world? Then think about time. Printing press, 1600s, I think that would have started. Maybe, well, maybe that's a way to then circulate. Airplanes, radio, TV, internet. But now here's the question. How is the whole world defined? It's going to be preached in all the world. We don't know. God knows. But here's a couple of thoughts. How many languages are there? 8,324. But not all of them are active. 7,000 are still used to be spoken or signed. And it's also sometimes difficult to separate a language from a dialect. I won't turn here, but here's a thought I had. Speaking with a friend at the feast, there's often contemplation about what happens at the end with the famine of the word. And does that mean that the word disappears or we're not able to get the message out, or how does that work? Well, I would just highlight Amos 8 and verse 11. It doesn't say that there's going to be a famine of the word. What it says is there's going to be a famine of the hearing of the word. What if search engines all of a sudden don't populate responses? What if people can't find the information that they're looking for? There might be different reasons why there could be a famine of the hearing of the word at the end. Okay, let's continue on. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in a holy place, whoever reads this, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. I had a chance to visit with my wife's uncle a week or two ago, and I was asking Matthew 24, when we read this, some of these things just don't quite make sense to me. So this was one. What would it matter about flight in the wintertime or on the Sabbath when that was written? And who knows exactly, but remember when I said that there's different interpretations of who Matthew is intended for. One consideration is about 70 AD, if the flight was going to be on a Sabbath, all the good Christians and Jews at that time wouldn't have been traveling. So you would have been a moving target, a known target, and here you are if it was on the Sabbath day. I don't know. So it's something to consider. Let's also think about what is the abomination of desolation. So in Daniel, it's really clear what that was foretelling. And it was Antiochus Epiphanes, the desecration of the temple. He sacrificed a pig. He had sacrificed many pigs on the holy altar and made practicing Judaism a capital offense. Now, what is the abomination of desolation? What does it exactly mean here? We don't know. Some believe, maybe so, that that means that the temple will be reestablished and there will be a sacrifice happening. And then there will be an abomination desolation of that. Could be, likely. I don't know. I can say this. When we were in Jerusalem a year ago, there was one section of a museum we went to where they're trying to gather old artifacts, anything they can find related to the temple or make things that would, as they would have been in the temple. They're trying to gather material. They're looking for the red heifer, which is another prophetic item. That's something else. There's also times when there have been groups of people trying to storm the Temple Mount to then have sacrifice. So as we were walking up this trail, or it's like a city street towards the Temple Mount, there was kind of a Starbucks. It was like a coffee shop. And the tour guide said several years ago, that was the furthest that some of the Israelis got with, I think it was the lamb at that point. And they were trying to run the lamb up onto the Temple Mount. They couldn't go any further, so they sacrificed a lamb just outside of Starbucks. So that was their thing. But exactly what does this abomination of desolation mean? I don't know. I would encourage each of you read further, dig deeper. But if that's happening, that's a really bad sign. But then let's continue on. Verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation. So all of these things are still before great tribulation. Wow. Such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh will be saved alive. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. How could they have thought no flesh would have been saved alive back in the first century? The very first time that that verse could apply, truly, in the entire world, 1947. The doomsday clock, and that time continues to march on. I did some study as far as nuclear weapons. You know, there used to be 70,000 active nuclear weapons, but then with the Great Reduction, there's a total of 12,000 in the world. You say, oh, good, only 12,000. It only needs 1,000 to wipe out the entire world. The U.S. has 5,700. Russia has 5,600. So between us, that's the majority. China has 500. Oh, sorry, I misspoke. China has 500. It's only 500 that's needed to wipe out the world. So China can do it once. Russia and ourselves can do it many times over. Ukraine gave up all their nuclear weapons in return for security guarantees in 1994 from a collection of countries, including US, UK, France, China, and Russia. I'll give you some speculation. What's a good prophecy sermon without some speculation? This is going to be going way out on the fence. Things are either going to get better or worse. But let's talk about what I mean by that. The most recent Home Office update, it was mentioned, peace, prosperity, and security are common refrains. So think about, I was reading, when the Iran hostages were being held under President Carter, at that time for quite a while, President Carter was like, hello, excuse me, would you please give us our hostages back? That didn't go so well. And then President Reagan said, you need to give us our hostages back now. And we got the hostages back. Almost a similar replaying with Gaza. Hello, for the last year, you're holding some of our hostages, but also other hostages. And you might have seen the quote from President-elect Trump that if we don't get our hostages back in the next month, holy hell will break out on Gaza. Now, all of a sudden, I've seen a couple of different news clippings of there's a chance the hostages are going to be released soon. Surprise. Okay, now when I said speculation, things will get better or worse. Things could get better as far as could some of the hot wars simmer down? There are currently 9 supposed hot wars based on a Wikipedia article that includes Congo. I didn't realize that was a hot war, but also Ukraine and Russia. Conversely, things get worse. On November 21st, Putin said that the Ukraine war is going global. North Korea is brought in. There's all kinds of different people. So the thing I'm wanting to highlight here, things might get better or might get worse for just a little bit, but don't let that change the fact that there will be wars and there will be rumors of wars. And there will be times where it gets a little bit better and there'll be times where it gets worse. And at the very end, it will get much worse. But early on, it says, don't let that be something that troubles you. On this point, Barclays had a little story. I found it intriguing. It was a made-up story about a conversation between Satan and 3 demons. The 3 demons came to Satan and said, how can we best tempt and ruin men and women? First demon said, I've got the idea. Let's tell them that there's no God. Satan said, that won't delude too many. Although I would say these days, the number of atheists, there are quite a few deluded. Second one says, let's just say there's no hell for sin. Satan says, you won't deceive many that way. The third one says, let's just tell them there's no hurry. Okay. Satan said, go, you will ruin them by the thousand. So the concept that there's no rush, there's no hurry. We can't always be on the gun lap. It's not always a sprint. We're here for the duration. But we also have to realize there's a quote that says, tomorrow is one of the most dangerous words out there because none of us really know about tomorrow when that will come into our lives. Just a year ago, I stood on the corner of Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. That's not a tourist-friendly place now. I was 3 miles from Gaza, where David and Goliath fought in the Valley of Elah. That's not a tourist-friendly place now. What's going to happen a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? We don't know. Okay, verse 23. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there, don't believe it. False Christ and false prophets. So here's the third time that white horse is mentioned. It's mentioned earlier, false Christ, then it was false prophets. But let's take this a little further. False Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the very elect. According to Wikipedia, there have been 54 people who have claimed to be Christ. The first one was Dositheos. He was a Samaritan mid-first century, and he tried to persuade Samaritans that he was the Messiah prophesied by Moses. He supposedly knew John the Baptist and was either a teacher or rival of Simon Magus. But there have been many a times where there's false Christs, false prophets, making quotes and statements. October of 1964, the Seventh-day Adventists were sure that that was when Christ was going to return, because it was 120 years after the great disappointment of 1844, when they were then convinced that Christ was going to return. That 120-year gap, they thought, was because of the days of Noah, of 120 years. They thought, well, if we had the date almost right then, add another 120, that's going to do it. Not quite. Our history isn't perfect on setting a date or guessing either. There is a person out there in a different church who's hurt many and makes many predictions. But did you know, a week from Monday, he says Christ is coming back, December 16th. And I would say, don't be too worried, because he had four missed predictions earlier this year. So this is number five. But there's still people who are trying to add this and subtract that and look at this date. That's not the way to go. No man knows. That's how Christ could have told us with verse 36 early. But we should be watchmen and be looking at these signs and be considering. Let's think about this. What's the difference between a sign and a wonder? Pretty similar, but not quite identical. A sign appeals to understanding, and a wonder appeals to imagination. An example of a sign is Gideon. The fleece, dry, wet. How does that work? That was a sign. A wonder, an example could be Moses. Josh talked earlier, and thanks, Josh. Or Moses' staff. So Moses had a staff that turned into a snake. Now the Egyptian magicians, their staff supposedly turned into a snake. One legend had it that if you hold a snake in just the right way, you paralyze it or freeze it. And that's what they did, and they threw it down. So it was trickery. Who knows exactly what it was? But what we do know is Moses' snake ate all of their snakes. That was a wonder. So if you think about signs and wonders, amazing things. But this says that there's going to be great signs and wonders ahead. What will those signs and wonders be? Well, we don't know. If we knew, then nobody would be fooled. But there will be great signs and wonders ahead that, if possible, would deceive the very elect. Verse 26, therefore, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, don't go out or look. He's in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man. So this just highlights, when Christ returns, he's not going to sneak in to the world and then all of a sudden, like, slowly reveal himself to the world. It's going to be huge. So verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This is the happy day clock. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. They will gather together his elect from four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. So we should anticipate and be looking forward to Christ's return. There's an elder for Cincinnati North that many of you might know named Bruce Kiewit. When Bruce was anticipating retirement a few years ago, he set two different clocks on his iPhone. One of them was the number of days, and one was the number of minutes before his retirement. If he was ever in a tough meeting, he would just have to look down. How many more hours do I have? He would know what that clock would signify, and that would be something he could look at with excitement. When I asked him a while back if I could share that story, he showed me he still had the clock running, but at that point, it's now 1,137 days since his retirement. So yes, he does still have it going, but we should consider what we can do to really look forward and anticipate the happy day. And the other thing to consider is this: none of us know when that day will be for us. We could all potentially be alive when Christ returns, although again, I'm not betting on a week from Monday, but when Christ does return, we likely all won't be here. And that's okay. The next moment, in the twinkling of the eye, that next moment with the trump when Christ returns, the dead in Christ rise first, the lost will rise in the air, that will be the moment. And who knows what the doomsday clock will be set on? Well, you look at that. We've still got lots of time. Actually, that's, I think it might be a little bit slow. We're wrapping up here soon. But the idea of, we don't know when any of our time is, but whenever that next moment is, it doesn't matter how many seconds are left on the doomsday clock. What happens if there's a bad month ahead and in Chicago, the setting of the doomsday clock goes to 2 seconds? It doesn't matter. From our perspective, we know the world doesn't end that way. It would frighten the world. It shouldn't frighten us because we have the hope, the ultimate hope of what happens with the happy day, not the doomsday to follow. Verse 32, actually, let's just jump to verse 36, and we'll just read this part through, and then I'll conclude. Of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. As the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. In the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. There's not going to be any advertisement. The two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Now, this could be more predictive of actually when Christ returns. When Christ returns, the dead rise first, then those of us who are alive on earth, maybe one is taken to meet Christ and the other saints in the air, and one not. Two women grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other one left. Watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord is coming. I'll conclude with verse 46. Blessed is that servant who his master, when he comes, will find so doing. So consider this. What chapter follows Matthew 24? It's a really tough question for you young children, especially. It's Matthew 25, right? What's Matthew 25 talk about? The parable of the 10 virgins. So I would also then say, it's easy to highlight after Christ was asked the question, the doomsday question, Jesus Christ, tell us, when will this be? He didn't just go to verse 36 and verse 42 first. He talked about what ultimately became the four horsemen. He talked about, here are all the signs to come, the abomination of desolation. Here's all these things. But then he follows that with, blessed is the servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. And then that naturally transitions into Matthew 25 with a highlight for, and a message for all of us to be wise, to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. So in conclusion, the Manhattan Project scientists weren't the first ones to ask the question about when will this happen. The disciples did. Many of us potentially have too. Although the doomsday clock has moved back and forth through the years, God's plan's on a steady pace. 2,000 years ago, would God have been surprised that 2,000 years later, Christ hasn't come back yet? No, that was a part of his plan. We just didn't understand. When will he come back? No man knows. After some of these signs go further along, then that should set up the end. So when we pray the kingdom come, we're really asking God to bring that great and glorious day, the glad and rad day, the happy and snappy day. Jim Croce sang, if I could save time in a bottle, the first thing I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away just to spend them with you. I'd like to conclude with the thought that eternity is not going to pass away. So the concept of the doomsday clock is that's the end of everything, and that's it. Our concept of the happy day is this is the very end of the beginning. And what happens after that? Eternity. So Jim had a beautiful song. I still hear the melody in my mind's eye. But what he missed is, it's not that eternity is going to pass away. The world is not going to end this way. We know that Christ is going to return, and he's going to come back in a very public instant. In the twinkling of an eye, the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive will rise to meet him in the air. So it's not the beginning of the end. It's the end of the beginning, with eternity to follow.